So welcome, everyone. Welcome. This is a continuation of the theme we've been on now for a year and a half on the foundations of mindfulness. And we are now on the third foundation, but don't, if you're new to the class here, don't think, oh my God, I'm out of place because I've missed the first two. I think you can find a seat in any of the talks because they're talks not so much that are based upon all the other talks I've given, some 25 or 30 talks, but because they establish us in reference to the body and the mind. And the third foundation is the mind. We're looking at the mind and we're picking apart some of the states of mind that many of us have that are rather difficult. We've gone through fear. We've gone through desire. I can't remember what we've gone through. We've gone through a lot of them. And we'll go through some more. And each time, that is not the end of the subject. Obviously, as we're speaking about division through anger tonight, one talk in a couple of weeks on the subject is not going to bring a resolution. It's going to be an ongoing intention within our life to settle some of these states of mind out so that we understand them sufficiently so that they no longer draw us down back into the form of reactivity. Right? So again, this is a longitudinal practice. This is something that for most of us, we have to just keep committing ourselves to learning and understanding the reactive patterns at hand, not to expect them to be gone with a single talk and a single surveillance, inward perspective. So this subject of anger, division through anger, because we're looking at how the mind divides itself into two. The mind itself, inherently, there's one mind. It's a one mind. There's unity. All of the spiritual truths and wisdom come within that unification of seeing. When we talk about oneness, when we talk about wholeness, when we talk about openness, when we talk about awareness, all of those are manifested within a mind that is not divided against itself. How does a mind get divided against itself? Each of us pull back, claiming to be outside the mind, looking and having a mental experience. The sense of ourselves is a mental experience. And until and unless we include the sense of ourself as a mental experience within the whole working of the mind, we remain divided by having a state of mind we don't like and a state of mind we do like and all of that. You can hear the resistance and the division that's created from part of the mind holding in some abhorrent form of the other half of the mind, or in some very attached way, trying to hold on to that particular state. So what we want to do is just relax with some of this stuff, understand our way through it, begin to look at some of these difficult states of mind, like fear, like anger, and just commit ourselves to organizing ourselves so that we're not dividing ourselves out from it, so that we aren't in terror of anger when it does arise, that we begin to be comfortably attentive to whatever state arises without having to do something about those states in some kind of awkward and further divisive way. And I thought tonight what I would like to do is to start with emotions themselves. What is an emotion? How do they arise? They're very amorphous and they're not easily understood, and we give them incredible sense of validity in ourselves. Some of us feel that we sort of intuit life because we're in touch with our emotions. But when you really look at what an emotion is and its derivation, it's no more certain or verifiable than a thought. It doesn't have any more truth than a thought has. Why is that? Because those two feed each other. They're, as we mentioned in an earlier a foundation, there are feelings, liking or disliking or not having any particular tone about something, an indifferent tone. When an experience occurs, a feeling arises with it. When a thought occurs, a feeling arises with it. When an emotion occurs, a feeling arises with it. An approaching or an avoidance of what it is that's being felt or being heard. And that experience, often through the feeling, brings forth a whole history, often psychological history, psychological difficulty, often an elaborate story, often from childhood, that has to do with some familiar component within that experience, like what I'm emoting in the moment. And so you have this feeling and this experience, and then the feeling of the experience, and then what comes through that is a narrative that embellishes that feeling tone to make it into a historical reference for the person who's having it. And then the body begins to respond to the story energetically through an emotion. And that emotion then picks up further thoughts, often reactive thoughts, in relationship to the emotion we're having, if it's an aversive emotion, like anger. Or if it's a lovely emotion, an endearing emotion, then it brings forth gentle thoughts or tender thoughts. And the story sort of then establishes or guides us into a mood. And if that mood is lasting enough, and if the story keeps embellishing it over time, then we have an attitude in which we now meet life. And that attitude started with a simple feeling, a simple pleasant or unpleasant approach to an experience. And then it gained momentum depending upon how much we invested thinking and story-wise into that particular simple experience we had. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're very, very volatile experiences, and they carry a huge emotional uplift. The body, if you, in meditation, you get a feeling for where emotions come from, most of us will find that they aren't mentally manifest. They're more in the heart center. You can feel emotions emanating from the center of your chest. And so the emotions aren't necessarily a brain manifestation. They're more of a bodily manifestation. The brain does its thinking, the body does its emoting. And those two can feed each other. An emotion can lead to thoughts. An emotion can just arise from the body. If you're sitting at some point and you may just have released a particular emotion that's in the body, and then suddenly you feel irritable for no reason whatsoever, except the irritability was released in the body. But when you open your eyes, you want to validate why it is that you feel, or justify why it is that you feel irritable. So you say, well, that person was shuffling around the whole time. How could I not feel irritable? You'll find an experience so that you can justify the emotion you're having. Many emotions are just arising, just from being locked into the tissues and cells of our body. And the other can happen as well. When you have a thought, you're sitting and somebody is moving or restless next to you, it starts off as just a simple experience of restlessness, but then the mind pulls back in aversion and says, oh, he shouldn't be doing that. And then, well, as soon as you say that to yourself, you're going to have the accompanying emotion that verifies that he should not be doing that, which is irritation, annoyance, or whatever it might be. And then more thoughts, because once you have an irritating emotion, you now have justification for more thoughts and more attitudes to surface around that particular experience. And on and on and on it goes. From what? From what? We're out of control. This is crazy making. When you hear it like that, I don't know about you, but there's something in me that says, enough. Enough of this. Just say that whole scenario to yourself over time. Watch it as an experience. Watch it come forward as an experience, and you'd think, God, this is completely out of control. And we give so much validity to our emotions. I remember Ellen and I, we were looking for a house to rent. This is many, many years ago. It was here in Seattle, probably almost 20 years ago. And we were both Dharma students. I was teaching the Dharma even back then. And we went to a landlord, and he looked at us and he says, you know, I'm very sophisticated in intuitively knowing the goodness of people, and I'm not renting this house to you two. Now, he's off. Because, believe me, his house would have been in good condition after we had left. But he thought he had really seen something or felt something, right, that gave him some validity to make that determination. Well, okay, so, but we give so much validity to what? To a kind of, you know, maybe we don't like the pants somebody's wearing or we don't like their facial, whatever it is. It doesn't make any difference, but we associate it immediately from a context of someone who we might have had an unpleasant experience with, or our father, or our mother, and suddenly they carry the emotional calcification of that experience. We just accept it and move right along with it instead of saying, wait a minute, this is crazy. They have nothing to do with my former time. Let's give them a break and me as well within that. And oftentimes there are so many emotions that are occurring simultaneously, we just feel that, you know, everything is happening up here and we don't have any, we're just pointing fingers kind of randomly because we can't, there's so much confusion going on. Remember, we have 100 billion neurons firing, bits of information that each have their hold on a particular historical point and feeling tone. It's no wonder that we sometimes feel overwhelmed or flooded emotionally by what's going on internally. And so when we come to anger, I would like us to stop and think about what that word means to us, anger. You know, just because oftentimes it has a childhood connotation. We feel that there could be some threat, physical harm or emotional abuse going on within that word. So pain is often associated with the word itself, as we just sit with the word. And because pain often accompanies, or fear often accompanies pain, fear can be a secondary emotion to the anger that we're feeling. And that somehow this sense of anger doesn't sit alone as just itself. It has a whole history, a whole narrative reference, a whole aversive tone to it. And besides just the anger, there is a fear relationship to seeing someone angry or being angry ourselves. This is what it begins with. We haven't even looked at the experience, the current experience that's bringing it forward. This is when it first comes. It carries all that baggage. But we're just so convinced that all that's true. You see, we don't sort it out. We don't rest with it. We don't say, okay, let me just feel this. We don't feel it. Some of us feel like we should be Buddhist diplomats and be serene all the time, and that anger has no place within that serenity, right? We should have this. on our face all the time. And at one teacher's meeting, we had some monks present, nuns as well, and the monastics said to us, many of us who have been to monastics, so we knew it well anyway, but the monastic says, you know, we won't allow anger to surface in our, within our monastic experience. It's not okay to be angry. And they were doing a lot of psychological work in their monasteries just so that they could find a place for this very human emotion. So it's not with, it's an emotion that carries an enormous reservoir of conditioning, a lot of tension and fear, a lot of emotional explosion forward. And for instance, I mean, I'm full of stories about, I was much younger, probably 30 some years ago, I was living in Texas. We were working at a hospice there, and I was new to Houston, where I was living. I was driving along. Somebody cut me off rather abusively in a car, and I slammed on the brakes, and he was looking, and he flips around, looks at me, and I go like that to him, because I was angry. And so then I move on, and he follows me. And he follows me for several miles and to home. So I thought, you don't know what you're getting into. So you know, and then he gets out of the car. I roll the window down this much. Yeah. He says, "Boy, I don't know where you're from, but we don't do that thing, that kind of thing in Texas." Well, he said, I mean, it has a whole context. You know, this kind of eruption of emotion has a whole context, and sometimes it's a cultural context. It has a cultural context here in this country. There's a lot of anger in this country. And we'll get to, in a moment, we'll get to see how that, where that comes from in terms of the way we're inducted psychologically with the way that we are brought up in this country, that anger is going to be a conditioned part of that upbringing, more than many other countries. But that sense of somehow anger doesn't have a place within our consciousness, that we're on the high road of spiritual journey where we're more noble than anger. Nonsense. We're down in the mud. We have our fingernails dirty. This is plant. You ever seen a rice farmer? They're down this high in water planting these little sprigs. That's the kind of snakes, water snakes all around them, water buffalo, all of that. We're down getting our feet, anyway. So this is down and dirty Dharma. And every one of you should feel that. We're all dirt farmers in this business. Because when you take on subjects like anger, there's no way to stay clean and pristine and bucolic, and you know, like you don't. That's all image. This is hard stuff, and it often does not feel very noble whatsoever. It's interesting because you can really see where your Dharma resolve is when you get angry. You know, I'm going to really understand anger, right? So then you get angry, and how willing are you to explore it? You want to manifest it. You want to throw things, right? You aren't interested in looking at it. You're interested in acting it out. You're interested in the carrying out the feeling message of it. Or I often say that you can't be angry and listen to the opposition at the same time, because in order to be angry, you have to drop your opinion, and your opinion formed the anger. So if you ever want to try this one, when you're angry at your spouse or a significant person, try listening to them, and you can't stay angry. But watch your Dharma resolve in that, because you don't know. What you really want is the power and position of the anger. You aren't interested in the listening. If you go through the motions of it, it'll be just to kind of, you know, okay, I want to listen to you, but you're not, in back of your mind, you're holding on to, you know, your territory, your opinion and view. So it really does challenge our Dharma resolve. Are we really willing to listen? And can we step out of this reaction? One of the things that's been very helpful for me whenever anger arises is just to explore whether I feel hurt or afraid. Those are the basic foundations on which anger can grow. And to understand which one I'm feeling through this, but to even ask ourselves that question requires a kind of Dharma resolve that takes us away from the influence of the reactivity. And there are few emotions that hold us within the message of their deliverance like anger does. I hope you already know that, don't you? You should. Where you have looked at your anger sufficiently to see how what you get out of it is, you know, you're somebody in that moment. And because we have lived in this culture feeling discounted, feeling insignificant, this is the cultural influence that I spoke about last talk about self-doubt. To have a moment of anger is a moment in which I'm not doubting myself. It's a relief from the doubt we carry, from the unworthiness we harbor. And so to have relief from that unworthiness, we foster anger. In fact, some of us can't get themselves motivated to say the things they want to say when they're in their normal consciousness because the doubt is what carries the message within the normal consciousness. I shouldn't say this. So we have to kind of invite or invest anger into the situation so that we can say what we really feel in that moment. I know many of you have that. So anger is often a way to offset the sense of self-negation we feel. We feel dismissed. We feel rather meaningless most of our life because of the kind of doubt we carry that we're just barely keeping our head above water. And so anger in some ways invites a sense of relief from that, a sense of release from that. You might think of anger as a fighting to deserve to live from that perspective. Now, as I go through there, I'm looking at the main causes and stories that follow our anger and this sense of self-unworthiness or insufficiency. When somebody says something or dismisses you or doesn't listen to you or you don't feel heard, that's why anger is arising in that moment. And it's a will to continue to live. It's a fight to deserve to live within yourself. It's sad, isn't it? That we have to find our will to live within an emotion that is as destructive as this one. And we can get enamored with it because we feel, for the moment, we feel on high ground. We feel like we've been validated. And so we can get enamored with the emotion itself because where it allows us to raise up above the slop of what we usually feel about ourselves. And many people find that anger is a very quickly conditioned part of their lives for that reason. We can assert ourselves through anger. We can know ourselves. So that's one aspect of anger. Now, if you're a Dharma student, you want to know what the story is that's driving this. You want to know the pain that compels the anger forward. You don't want to just stop at the anger, because behind the anger is an attempt. The anger is a symptom, you might say, of trying to overcompensate for the feeling of unworthiness. So you want to know or get a sense of that unworthiness, which we talked about when we talked about doubt a few weeks ago. You want to get a sense of that. See, you got, that's where you get the dirt in your fingernails. This is pig farming. So another way that anger compels us forward through our story is that unworthiness is one. Through unworthiness, or some way that our unworthiness is set off, the story or the narrative of our unworthiness is set, and it can be very innocent. Somebody can just not say, you say, "Hi, how are you today?" And they don't say anything, and suddenly you're angry. And that's what happened. Another way is loss of control. All right, lose your car keys. Now I find that very interesting. You see, I really encourage us to flesh out all the ways that control establishes a sense of feeling tone for us. And that the simple loss of control, a time when things don't go according to how I tried to fix them or make them, throws us off into a kind of vulnerability that we equate with death. Vulnerability is equated to death and dying for us. When we're vulnerable, when we're out of control, that's what we think of. That's where we go. It's equivalent. We're getting, again, part of it is that we're getting pushed around by unseen forces here. We feel victimized. And so part of it, again, is the unworthiness. But mostly it's not that. It's feeling like I'm counting on the world to be known to me. I'm counting on the world to be certain. I'm counting on that. And when it's not, when I have put so much of my reputation and purpose and meaning, infused it into the world to make sense, and then it doesn't make sense. It's as if I've been betrayed by forces that are. And so what is this sense of control? I mean, it's time we really took that one apart and examined it thoroughly. Can we control the basics, like what we see, hear, smell, taste, or think? Because that forms the foundation for perception. Now, if you don't have control on those six sense doors, then your house is on a fault line. And if you look, even though you say, "I'm coming to Tuesday nights," you have no idea what your perceptions will be when you get here. It's an idea. Tuesday night is an idea. You come, it's completely different. Completely different perception, sounds. You don't know what I'm going to say. Bah! Did you expect that? You just lost your car keys. You see? But we don't have control over any of our senses. And yet that we can constantly conceive of a firmness of life, of a certainty to life that belies the truth of it. And so, of course, anger is the result of that. So there's the sense of being negated or unworthy, or this sense of self-doubt arising. That's one way that anger arises, to overcompensate for that feeling of self-diminishment. The second one is when we lose the feeling of certainty, of control in life, of what we know and expect life to be. That's certainly true if we ever become ill or have a traffic accident or anything that takes us slightly off the anticipated path we're on. And then there's also the most common, I think, expression or manifestation of anger is it separates us from something we deeply care about. Something that we care about deeply, something's been thwarted or blocked. That event, experience, person has been blocked from us. And we get angry. This should not be happening, we might say. This should not be occurring. Something we care about is threatened. Now, if you understand loss, then you'll understand that when we are separated from something we care about, that is a grief response to life. And part of the dynamic of grief is anger. That's a facet of bereavement. And so anger naturally will arise when something we care about isn't occurring or has been blocked from us. But instead of focusing in on the grief component, which makes us vulnerable, you see, if you just feel the sense of loss that you didn't get what you wanted, maybe it might have been anything. It could be anything. It could be, you know, in terms of political persuasion or righteousness or justice. All these things are just something we deeply care about but don't always go our way. And we get angry about them. But what's really happening is that the caring is still there. We just realize it's not going to be accomplished. It's not going to be completed. And there's this tremendous sense of loss or tremendous sense of grief that we hold. But because the sense of grief we embody takes us to vulnerability, much like the loss of control took us to vulnerability, which is really the same thing, we prefer the anger because anger doesn't show the vulnerable side of us. It shows the power side of us. It shows the retaliatory side of us. And to cover over the vulnerability of the grief, we get angry. Right? So you begin to see that. You begin to think, oh, this is grief. And then with your Dharma understanding, instead of focusing on the angry aspect or quality of grief, you go to the loss quality, because that takes you back into the tenderness of the heart. So, oh, I really cared about this issue. And I'm feeling grief that it's not happening. I really wanted that bill to pass or that law to be. And you just feel that. You feel the sadness of it. And what happens when you allow ourselves to be vulnerable is that tenderness arises. The heart can arise. Within vulnerability, the heart, compassion can arise. And wisdom can arise. Not in anger, we are manifesting the state itself. It's not a tender emotion. It's not an emotion that is interested in this opening. In grief, we're opening. We're letting life inform us about what it did not provide, what we hoped for but did not occur. And anger, we're moving forward. We're attacking it. And so when you're ever in that mode where you're leaning into in an attack formation, you're not learning a thing. You're just establishing position, establishing your position in power in that moment. But it feels good because you're counteracting the grief of the vulnerability. So it makes you feel like you're doing something. You're angry at the doctor who just told you that you had a spot on your lung. instead of opening it to the and reflecting upon the ephemeral quality of life and that and being touched by that and open to it. Now the doctor, I'm getting another, you know. You say, well, that's a normal human response. That's a normal crazy response. The mind is not a sane machine. So we can redirect. You see, anger is a perspective. It is a self-confirming view. It is around power and influence. And it gets its perspective from the story it's telling itself about what should be happening. Now you have another story right across the aisle from you, or next door, or the neighbor, or the person across the street. You have as many different stories and as many different emotional reactions to the same event. What makes us so claim reference and priority to our own? Wisdom is realizing that your opinions do not hold any more importance than anyone else's. And to really understand that is to release the anger fuse of the power associated with that positionality. And what happens is that you then can stay connected. The first and most important dharmic practice is to stay connected in the anger. Stay connected to the anger, and if you can, stay connected to the person you're angry with. And I don't mean in an abusive situation. You put a lot of distance between them, between you and that person. But staying connected is the beginning of a reclaiming of the love or the union that is absolutely necessary for the healing of whatever it is that just took place. Staying connected. Now, sometimes staying connected takes funny forms. I can't be around X or Y because of the history I've had with them, and instead of being separated and seething in your separation, you don't have to do it that way. You could just take the time away, take the time out. And sometimes that could be months or years where you're taking a time out from somebody who you just can't be with. But you're still staying connected in your heart. You're still working, reorganizing, realigning that so that that sense of connection can continue. Because even anger needs love. When it arises, it needs love. It needs the love of your connection, of your willingness to see it, of your willingness to flush it out, see what's there. What's hidden in there? What am I trying to tell myself? What's behind there motivating the story and narrative of the anger? Staying in relationship. There's no growth without connection. We all know that here. You're never going to grow disconnected. What are you going to grow with? Just you're going to grow. The only thing you can grow with disconnected is you're going to further your opinionation about something because you're not connected, so you can't ever renew that relationship. You're just going to fester in the old one. Have you ever had that where you have a friend or somebody who you're not completely comfortable with, a little bit of suspicion, and you have a lot of space between you, and you seethe, and you have this whole story about them, you meet them, and it's none of that is true at all. And you go, oh my God, I've just been, where have I been? Well, this is where you've been. You haven't stayed connected. There's been no way for that to be released, for the pressure of that to be released. And so this sense of willingness, the whole of the Dharma really lies within that single word of connection. And so when instead of when we're acting from the state of anger, we're not connected to the anger. We are exploding out from the anger. We are just manifesting its energy. But we're not connected to it. In fact, we may not even know in the moment of that explosion that we are angry at all. Only 15 minutes after the event, well, oh wow, so angry. If we want to transform the anger, we have to be present with it, of course. And the idea of changing it, and this is the big one, because many, many, many Dharma students get caught in this serenity. You know, I shouldn't be angry, and something's wrong with my practice that anger is arising. There's nothing wrong with your practice that anger is arising. Are you willing to look at it? Where's your practice when anger is arising? Don't say there's something wrong with it. If you just look at the anger, you're right there, right where you should be. And the transformation occurs within the tenderness of your looking. Wow, this really hurts. It hurts when you feel the anger, when you feel the cold burning flame of the anger and you realize you're hurting yourself by not holding yourself accountable to that emotion, but blaming that emotion on whatever the objects are external to you, which is itself 10 steps off Dharma path. You go, wait a second here. I'm doing this to myself. And I don't want to hurt myself anymore. Now, what am I doing here that keeps creating this kind of unconscious distance? So am I hurt or afraid? If I'm hurt, let me open to the wound of my grief. If I'm afraid, let me see what it is that I'm anticipating might occur that, or has occurred that frightens me. Am I willing to listen? Am I willing to establish a relationship with the person whom the anger is arising in relationship to? Am I willing to listen to myself and what I'm saying to myself through my narrative that is often an over-exaggeration or an overcompensation for the misery I feel in the moment? Am I being accountable for my emotional life? Can I feel that there's no justification in looking external for the reason that I'm angry, that this is an internal response? And I may need to converse and have communication with people to straighten out confusion, but the emotional response I'm having in relationship to what I'm seeing is mine alone. Nobody is inducing it in me. It's my response to the conditions I perceive and the story I'm telling myself. Do I see that? Am I willing to face the terror of being wrong? Especially in a culture that is so dependent upon being right, having the upper hand in our rightness, the first one called with the right answer. Anger's never right. It's never the only side of the story. It's never conclusive. It's never an absolute. And the terror of losing my position and falling from the pedestal I've set up may be just too much, in which case anger will continue. But my hope for you is that we together look at this thing, down as pig farmers, fingers dirty, slopping in the mud, saying, how are you doing? Man, I'm doing awful. So am I. I can't. It's all right, though. Right? Because therein lies the Dharma. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So you see why we sit? I just want to show you that, you see, you're just embodying, you're embodying whatever it is that's arising without influencing it. Which means you're not aversive to it, you're not clinging to it, you're just letting whatever it is pass through you like a wind through a canyon. And that sets us up. That shows us the disposition of life to itself. It gives us a moment or a few minutes in which we are living a reality that few of us ever actually take as truth for a way to live. Anger arises, and then it's gone. Because it is not being justified, it's not being blamed, it's just a conditioned phenomena among a lot of other conditions. So if there are any questions or comments that anyone would like to bring up, I'd be happy to see if I can answer them. Yes, sir.
Most of what you said about anger seems to me to also apply to anxiety. Are they related to one another?
Well, as I mentioned, that much of how we view anger has a fear component to it. So there's anger, and then there's a secondary emotion called fear. Much of how it is that we get entangled and reactive within our anger is due to the fear response we have of the anger rather than the anger itself. The anger is just the anger, but we're afraid of it. We're afraid that it means something. We're afraid that it implicates us somehow. We're afraid that it says something about us, that I'm an angry person. And in order to keep that level, that label at bay, the fear assures that we will live that image. It's very interesting. We think if we can resist it, we can keep it subversed enough, we can keep it suppressed enough so that it doesn't have any effect upon it. But the more tension we place between ourselves and any emotion, and fear is a huge amount of resistance and tension to something, that assures that the connecting force of that mind state will arise the moment the conditions are there for it too. And what will happen is that we'll be cast into the sea of that emotion and not be able, because it'll be completely unconscious. And so the first thing we have to do is to get a feeling for the background charge that we have with anger. And that's why I suggest just bring the word up in your mind. So, okay, anger. What is it? Ooh, my father, or, you know, whoa, gosh, my own. You know, just see what it does to you. See how we hold that emotion. See how we encase it. What's it calcified in? You say, wow, so this is the starting place. This is where we begin in our view of anger, is how it's charged when it comes to the surface. No matter what the experience is that's leading the anger up, this is how it's going to come up in its most fundamental way. It'll always be charged with this way because the anger itself holds this narrative about it. So to get a sense of that, and then to start getting a sense of how poorly our psyches are prepared for handling some of these emotions, because the emotions, we feel that we don't have a position in life. We feel our position in life is tentative. So if something can give us a position, a root system in life, like opinionation, so the more opinions we form, we feel like the more root system we have. But believe me, the more opinions you form, the more angry you're going to be, because people aren't going to accommodate those opinions. And so it's just the opposite. The root system, but because we feel rootless, we don't feel tied to our bodies, we don't feel embodied. And for those of you who weren't here for the first 15 talks I did on this subject, it was about the body. It was about how we don't feel embodied. We won't allow ourselves to feel that we belong here. We don't feel like we even belong in our bodies. We don't feel like we have a place on the earth. It's not ours. And so we're in a constant state of being uprooted, and of course that state is going to lead to a lot of angry outbursts, right? Because what anger does is it provides us a momentary assurance that we're in the right place, that we're saying the right thing, that it's our view that's correct. You see? So it makes us, it gives us a temporary home when we feel homeless. So all of these things do build upon themselves, and so as we encourage ourselves back into the body, as we allow ourselves to resettle back into the body, as we feel at home again into the body, as we feel like we have a stability of belonging within ourselves, then the causes, the antecedents of anger, just can't influence us in the same way. I mean, each of us, every day, when we first get out of bed, should just feel our bodies touching the earth and understand, and this is, whether you understand it dharmically at this point is of little importance to me, but just saying it and beginning to live the understanding that there's nowhere else I can be, I belong here. There is nowhere else I can be, I belong here. It is in this moment that I belong. And as you begin to see that in fact, and you begin to intend for that fact to show us the wisdom that it holds, then much of these emotional expressions, like fear, which is another sense of not belonging, why I'm not supposed to be here, I'm supposed to be somewhere else, this is too, doubt, anger, they have less and less hold on you. Embodied experience. Just a minute. Feel it. There's nowhere else you can be. Period. There is nowhere else you can be. That is an unarguable fact. I could not have come tonight. Then that's where you should have been. Moment after moment, it's not an arguable fact of where you can be. That's it. That's your belonging. It's only your mind that gives you alternatives. The body gives you no alternative as to where you can be. But to live that fact and to stop this constant interruption of story about all the possible, this shouldn't be happening to you. Why shouldn't it be happening to you? It should be happening to you because it is happening to you. It shouldn't be happening to you. If you want to go insane, bring that thought up. Other questions or comments? Yes.
What about situations where you see injustice, and anger arises. And, I mean, say, for example, with Libya, it's easy to be angry about what's happening there.
Okay, this is important. What about situations where fairness leads, the lack of fairness leads to anger? Is fairness a mental construct, or is it reality? Should big fish eat small fish? Should children die before their parents? Should the prisoner live longer than the minister? This is not a fair life. It has nothing at all to do with the way things are. Fairness is our mental construct. It's what we think it should be like. Right? It has nothing at all to do with reality. Nothing. Life simply is not fair. And as long as we think it should, we are going to suffer in relationship to the fact that it's not. Does that mean then we just give over and say, oh, the poor people of Japan, they're dying in droves? Well, no, of course not, because it's not fairness that brings our heart out. In fact, fairness just makes us angry. What brings our heart out is the compassion of seeing the sorrow. That's the clarity of that is what brings us, steps us forward. But we're so used to having to rally the troops through fairness issues and talking ourselves in, this is unfair, nobody should be hungry in this life. Well, people are hungry. Now feel the pain. In some ways, the fairness issue keeps you from feeling the pain. It's a way to blunt us from feeling the pain, from feeling the vulnerability of what it's like to feel the pain. This is unfair. How much easier is it to say that than to feel the pain of where the sorrow takes us? Okay, all, that's enough for tonight. Thank you.